Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the 67th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloney, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. Just want to thank everyone back to the podcast. Thanks for all the reviews, blog comments along the way, and we really appreciate that. We're on, episode 67 now, so we're getting closer and closer to that milestone episode 100.
Yep. And we want to just encourage everyone, as you listen to this week's episode, to tweet out using the hashtag EduAllStars. We love seeing the conversations and hearing about the different things that stick out to you. Our guest this week is Don Wetrick. He is an educator, international speaker and presenter, host of his own BAM radio show, and author of the brand new book, Pure Genius, Building a Culture of Innovation. Thanks, Don, for coming up on with us today.
Oh, my gosh, I'm honored. I'm so honored you had me on.
Well, Don, you know, the place we always like to start with our guests is just hearing a little bit about your background and how you ended up in education.
Yeah, that's a long and winding road. It's kind of a funny story. Everybody in my family was in education, and when I told my dad that I wasn't going to go into education, people kind of chuckled, and I think it's kind of a genetic thing. And so I spent my first 3 years out of college in a professional, non-educating setting, and I decided to go back, and I'll always remember that. It's kind of that famous story that I love to tell is that, you know, my parents paid for every cent of my education, and I greatly appreciated it. But then when I told him, like, hey, I'm going to go back and get my teaching license, you know, I didn't ask for him to pay for it or anything, but I always remember him, and he was just a great teacher anyway. And he kind of took a deep breath. He says, you know, Don, I don't care if you go on and teach for the next 20 years. Just please promise me you won't teach 1 year 20 times. And that's always stuck with me. And actually, within that year, I was like, okay, Dad. And I didn't really get it until I started seeing some people that were less enthused about being in education pass out the same ditto. And yes, I said ditto. yeah, I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember what dittos are. And so, so I then got into education, and I taught middle school for 10 years. Still have a very soft spot for that level. And then I took a brave adventure, and I took a broadcasting position at a high school, and it was the greatest opportunity ever because, you know, some of the equipment I learned on in college, it was in 1995, and all of a sudden it was 2008, and I was so 2000 and late, and I had no idea what I was doing. And that was the fun part of it because, you know, I got in there, and I'm like, hey, who wants to learn with me? And the kids... we did some really, really cool stuff, and then the really big transformation is when I started the innovation class, and I'll remember where I was sitting. I got that email from a friend of mine and said, hey, have you seen the Dan Pink TED Talk? And no, and watched it, and then, like, literally the next day, I made my students watch it, and we tried didn't have a genius hour. There was no term yet, so we just decided to do stuff, and I liked it so much that I applied to start an entire class around it, and it got approved, and that was it's an even longer story, but it was something that was an adventure worth taking. And then I was asked by another school last year to take it to a different level, and not that I didn't like the school prior, it was great, but Noblesville High School I'm at now, it's just outside of Indianapolis, Indiana, and the support I get there and what they want to do at that school is nothing short of miraculous. And it's not just my class. The entire school is they're going to be relevant nationally. I can feel it by the way they implement things. They're extraordinary.
So let's talk about Noblesville High School. Like, what makes them extraordinary that other schools, the stuff that you guys are doing now at that school that other schools are not doing?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, a lot of it is the support and buy-in. When they decided to go one-to-one iPad, they gave themselves like 2.5 years to research and know what deployment is. And if you want to follow Christy Steffen, the girl was it was miraculous on the teachers that are there. And I'm not, like, trying to step on the toes of, like, I'm sure you've seen the articles about the Los Angeles School Department and, you know, some of their decisions. They didn't get what a rollout was. They didn't get some of the pedagogy on what to do with an iPad, and they did at Noblesville. And when I got there, I was shocked because they utilize Canvas really well. They have e-learning days where it's not like they just send the kids home and, you know, pray for the best. Things are implemented there the right way. So the leadership at the top is amazing. Matter of fact, I hope my principal doesn't mind me saying this. When I first got there, I wasn't going to have – I got there late in the school year. So the really, I was going to be there for a month and then start the school year next year. And I'm like, hey, why do you want me to start early? And this – I'll never forget this. I said, you know, I won't have a class until next August. Why do you want me to start now? And Jeff Bryant was his name. And he says, I want you to think. What? He's, I want you to have time to think. I want you to be able to plan things out. I want you to design the best innovation course you can. I want you to get up here and learn the community, meet with them because they have a really supportive community. And it's a school that is okay with taking risks. And even said, if some of these things don't work out, okay, we'll adjust. So they know how to, they're not just, you know, walking the talk. They're, you know, they're not just talking talk, they're walking it as well. So they're risk averse. They do things that are experimental. Their iPad implementation has been great. Their pedagogy is great. Their support is great. It's been a breath of fresh air for me to be at a school like that.
So do you teach the same class throughout the day then? Is that what does it look like in your role?
Yeah, I mean the best thing I teach a couple sections of it. And I'm also, okay, so I kind of wear three hats. Number one, I reside over, I don't want to insult media specialists by telling people I'm a media specialist on the side, but we have, I reside over a library that they want to turn into an innovation center. Okay. We have a huge library, and because we've been so effective one-to-one iPad, well, a lot of the books are checked out digitally. So they had some discussions on, you know, downsizing the physical books and then starting to work with, and I'm hoping to, like, partnerships with Steelcase and places like that to open up an innovation center and then really utilize it, not just say, oh, we have an innovation center and it's pretty furniture and not to use. So I kind of am in somewhat of a small role of media specialist. I also kind of am a coach for some project-based learning in the school, and then I've got some sections of the innovation class, and really the best way I know how to describe an innovation class, it's 20% time, 100% of the time. I'm sure we'll get into the nuances on this interview, but it's been amazing and it's been a fun experience because my students are proving what can happen if you give them some time and some resources. They're knocking it out of the park, and I love it.
So talk me through an innovation center. What does it look like? What does it exist to do? What are your plans for it?
My plans, phase one, get more money. we're a little short on the funding right now. And you know what? And actually, Christy, Steph, and I had just met, and we're okay with that because, you know, one of my battle cries is constraints lead to creativity, and we're going to get creative. And we're going to find ways around it. I think that when you showcase great student work, you know, Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams theory, you know, if you build it, they will come. We'll build it and we'll keep growing it, I think, because right now, and really that's what the YouTube channel is for, is to start showcasing what we're capable of and what we're doing. So, you know, being as transparent as we can, which I think is ironically enough one of the most important things that most educators can do, is that, you know, you want to fight off bad comments about today's education, today's kids. Put a camera on today's kids and they'll shut people, well, I shouldn't say shut people up, they'll change people's minds. But yeah, the Innovation Center is collaborative workspaces, you know, total Stanford D school, you know, I'm not going to mince, I want it to look somewhat D schoolish. But then also then having some other resources that are going to be utilized. You know, I was giving some of my students a hard time because they immediately wanted to buy a 3D printer. And I said, look, I don't have a problem with that. What are you going to do with it? And I said, and don't tell me make keychains. And they said, well, Well, we were actually wanting to do some keychains. I'm like, look, so, and ironically enough, I can't really talk about it because my students have signed a. Again, more stories for later. I've got three students that just prototyped a child language development toy. That's all I can really say. And they prototyped it on the 3D printer at the middle school. So it's stuff that I just want to be utilized. I don't want to just buy stuff to look pretty. I don't want to buy collaborative work furniture for the sake of it being really cool looking. I'm a good steward of money. I was raised by educators, right? So I want it to be a good steward of money and make it look right, but make it very functional. And quite frankly, if the place looks right, invite the public in. I'm sure there's some young entrepreneurs in the greater Indianapolis area that might want to utilize the space at night, or maybe they want to help mentor my students in exchange for they get a little bit of time and space to work there. So the possibilities are endless.
I got to say, I feel like there's a paranormal activity thing going around back behind you. I saw the door open, and I was like, oh, my gosh, because the dark lights and everything. Sorry.
That's awesome. Oh,
that was funny. Okay,
better watch who's behind there. My wife's behind there, and she's getting ready for bed. So.
Hey, so just backing up just 1 second, if there's teachers out there that have not heard of Innovation Centers and Genius Hours and 20 Time Projects, like give the little paragraph speech about what that is.
That's a hard thing to do. So yeah, a 20% time. First of all, if anybody hasn't seen Daniel Pink's TED Talk, that's what influenced, I think, a lot of educators. And I'm not going to lie to you and said, oh, I thought this up. No, Dan kind of brought my attention to it. So if you were to get the traditional genius 20% time is if you were to give a student's 20% of their work week time to work on something they're really passionate about, that's their time to do it. An innovation class is basically that, except we tie everything still back to the standards. They write proposals, they write reflections. They have to work with an outside expert. So no working with your dad or your dad's buddies. We harness social media for all it's worth. We have a really open policy about that, and that's where we found our people we've collaborated with. So some of our students have worked with. Matter of fact, I have three students right now. A couple of them are working with professors at Georgia Tech and Purdue on some engineering stuff, and we've got a couple people that are working with app developers that work at Facebook and Google and just all over the place. So we're on an alternating day schedule. So, you know, when I was talking to the kids, I was like, you know, if I gave you an hour and a half to work on something you really, really wanted to work on, what would you work on? And that's my class. Within reason. I mean, if some student came up to me and said, I want to do a sleep study every day in your class and see how well I sleep, no, that's not gonna happen. But that's the other thing. The thing I like is that in the proposal stage, they turn in a proposal. They have a pitch day, which I love because that's where the students also give them feedback. They're gonna say, "Hey, I'm working on this project," and then my panel of experts will say, "Well, that's good, but have you thought about X, Y, and Z?" The students will also say, "Oh, I've got an uncle that has," and they pitch on that. Which, if I hope I'm not monologuing, but I have something important on that regard. I get a lot of people that are doing Genius Hour that write me. And they say, okay, I'm doing Genius Hour, now what? I ask kids, you know, work on something they're passionate about, and they say, I don't know what they're passionate about, which is a problem. Number one is I think a lot of schools have done a really good job of making sure our kids are subservient, and they have waited for instruction to do what we tell them to. So when I tell them, it's not what about I want, it's what about you want. I think there's two really big things that you have to do when you start off a 20% time project or an innovations class or whatever. Number one, you create this culture, and they laughed at this year, but I learned from last year. I told them on the first day, you guys have to love and trust one another in this class, because I have had some situations where a couple of groups did really well, and it created this atmosphere of jealousy, and it didn't go over well. And so we had a lot of, I hate to say team building experiences, but, you know, we did. And then once we started to get this whole dynamic going, that way on pitch day, if a student said, hey, I'm working on this project, now the other students would say, I've got an uncle that can help you, or, hey, even though that's not my project, can I help out? And that's wonderful. And second thing is, what if you have kids that have these huge ideas? And that's the other problem I hear is like they're like, hey, they started off with this huge idea, and now they don't know where to go. I think every smart genius hour project, your first project should be a feasibility study on whether you can do your first project. We've had some great ideas that they said, hey, we're gonna implement this in the school. And I said, you better do your research. So I give them, on the first part of the year, I give them a couple of weeks just to do a feasibility study, do some data collection, talk to end users. You know, I wanted to design this app where I, all right, fine, go out and ask the students if they've ever used that app. And sometimes they come back and they go, whoa, you saved me some time. Everybody thinks my idea is stupid. Or, oh, my gosh, when I was talking to people, they gave me an even better idea, and now I've changed it too. So I'm just a big, big, big fan of that first project being a study to see if you can actually go through with it.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea.
So, in the proposal phase, you know, they take charge of their own education. They research what standards they're knocking out. Or it's kind of a scientific method. They put in their proposal, I think that I'm going to be accomplishing these standards, which means that they're looking them up and they know what they mean. And in the reflection, we give kind of a TED talk, especially to the people they were working with. But then they also tell me, hey, I did master the standard and here's why. And that also goes into the grading piece, which I've never loved grading so much as I do now, because in the reflection, they tell me what they think that they deserve. And it's this bartering thing. You know, like when you go to you go to Mexico and you're trying to buy a blanket and they say $50, and you're like, no, come on, 20. It's some of my students, you know, basically you have to have 100 points in a semester to get that A+. If you have a 90, you have an A. So a 2 or 3 week project is, you know, essentially 20, 30, 40 points depending. Well, if they put down like 40 points and I say, well, I thought 20, if they can like really debate with me and like, no, I deserve 40 because I collaborate with this guy, I knocked out this standard, I never met this person before, I was online connecting with, and if they're emphatic and they're enthused about it, I'm like, yeah, fine, 40, 40 it is. And then on the other hand, I've had some projects where they're like, I'm hoping for a 30, and I'm like, well, I was going to give you 20. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't. I should have done better. But no, they're substantiating their own grades. They're really having a real dialogue with me as opposed to me arbitrarily giving them a grade. Or even, and I even had some rubrics in the past, and I still do, but there's even a lot of wiggle room with those just because there's some things that the rubrics just aren't going to cover on their process through innovation.
So, talk to us a little bit about your book and how that came about and how, as an educator, why would I even be interested in reading the book, Pure Genius?
So, I got to give credit where credit's due. I was out at Podstock last year, and Sherry Crowfoot almost put a gun to my head. Because she's like, oh, why aren't you writing the book? Why aren't you writing the book? I'm like, I don't know. I've got 3 kids, and I'm a pretty good teacher, but I'm a really good dad, and I didn't really know if I wanted to spend the time that it was going to take. And so she's like, oh, you got to. And so that's when I started writing things at night, which ironically enough, my kids are in bed right now, and I thought that'd be the best way. And why I wrote it is because I've never felt so enthusiastic and refreshed about education. I've always liked teaching. I've always loved teaching, I should say. But seeing some of the projects now are, not in a cliche way, but they're changing lives. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. By some of the events that they're starting, or some of the kids that they've helped, or, my gosh, some of the networking that these students get to do, you know, we went out to visit at Google last year, and it was great because the employees were like, they said, like, where were you 20 years ago? Why couldn't I have had this kind of class? And some of my experiences have just been downright fun, and I thought, you know, why not share it? So I went ahead and start writing at night, and which is an even funnier story on how I got it published. I've got to give credit where credit's due. Vicki Davis, I was choosing between a couple, and Vicki says, I don't know who Dave Burgess published, but he's doing really well. And talked to Dave, and so that ended up being a relationship that was almost brother-like. And I know that you know Dave. Mm-hmm. We finished each other's sentences. I think I can give some obscure old school rap reference, and he has me beat. but he's a great guy, and so yeah. So I end up having him publish it, which has been a really fun experience, especially with the editor he had. But the reason why I want teachers to read it is, you know, I think more people give. They hear buzzwords like Genius Hour and 20% Time, and I fear that it may be a buzzword unless you really look into it. And if you don't move past the buzzword, then you'll never know. And so I have just anecdotal stories here and there to kind of illustrate that this wasn't anything too difficult, that in some ways it's like, hey, let's give it a try. And you don't have to be a computer genius. And matter of fact, there's also this misconception that 20% Time has to be all tech and app writing. And while I definitely have my share of app writers, it's not the case. But I really, really think that we're at a tipping point. And I've never been so excited about education in my life. There's this dialogue. I mean, we all know that Twitter is now starting to really have that shift. And a lot of people on Facebook groups are starting to share things. And it's this cool movement that you're like, okay, if you don't start making some noise, then it's your fault. So I just wanted to be loud. I wanted to be transparent, and I wanted to hopefully inspire other teachers to call to action. And I would say, man, I'm going on, that a part of the book, and I was pretty deliberate in saying this, that I also want to help. I've had just the luxury of hearing back from a lot of teachers. Matter of fact, early on, like Andy McNair, and I'm pretty sure she's watching tonight, you know, I get to help teach an elementary school class, you know, like once a month and work with her kids. And so writing the book has also been a really great experience in the sense that I can now work with other teachers from all over the place that are really excited about it.
Talk about some of the, like your favorite projects you've seen over the last couple years or whatever.
Well, I'll give you the good and the bad and the ugly. The good, I've got some, well, okay, I had a really unique starter when I was trying to go over how to write a proposal and how to start harnessing social media. So a couple weeks ago when we started, actually it's been a month and a half ago, when we started school, I started off with a driving question. We were just having this open discussion because Mondays is our brainstorming time. And one of our driving questions was, what in the heck is going on in Israel and Palestine? And, you know, some of the kids were like, well, if you watch Fox, all Palestinians are terrorists, and if you watch MSNBC, and vice versa. So I said, all right. So we were walking through how to write that driving question and you know, what we could glean from it. So I said, all right, we can make this an all-group project. Start taking to Twitter and people that know people, and let's start talking to people over Skype. And they're like, you're kidding. How do we talk to somebody from the West Bank? I'm like, let's start. So we start sending out tweets and Facebook, and then, you know, this kid went to this church, and this guy knew that guy. And within a couple days, we were having some Skype calls with students and adults from Israel and Palestine and all this other stuff. So that was cool. And it showed, and that was eye-opening because, one, it was their first project as a starter project, but, two, they started to understand of, oh, social media really is for connecting. It doesn't have to be taking selfies and embarrassing yourself. So that one was really proactive. But then there's other projects like a couple years ago. And the reason why I started off with starting small, I had a girl that she was an unbelievably gifted volleyball player, being recruited by a lot of places, and her brother had pretty severe Down syndrome. And her project was she had been inspired and she had seen the Miracle League on Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel. And she's like, I'm going to start a league. I was like, wow, all right. So seemingly she had everything planned out, and we had no idea what we were up against. I mean, forget about the fact that we didn't really know that it took liability insurance. You have to have an army of volunteers. And we also started to find that the parents of the special needs students they wanted to go show up to the game, but these were people that were already pretty tired. And so we asked them, hey, do you want to pitch in? They're like, no. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I want to drive my child to the game, but no. And then we started to find out that you needed to, you know, started to apply for a 401(c) and a blah, blah, and all this other stuff. And it was in, I think, maybe November. She came into my room, and she was about ready to cry. She goes, I'm done. I can't do this. She's like, I started to finally play out the rest of the scenario because she had met great mentors. And even her mentors are going, when do you want to launch this? And she's like, I was hoping by Christmas. And then I go, no way possible. So at the end of that lesson, basically, she learned that she was going to have one game at the high school just to see how it went. Now, looking back, that's what we do now. Now we start looking at that feasibility study where I'd have given her 3 weeks just to play out the scenario and work backwards. Mm-hmm. So that one was unfortunate. It was still great. I've had some other really great projects that it failed. The product failed, but it was absolutely worth it. Had another student that I thought was this close to getting solar power brought to the school. It was funny because he was being entertained and kind of wined and dined by two different solar companies because they wanted the positive public relations out of it. And I thought he was going to do it, but the equipment was still, I mean, it was going to pay for itself in like 2 years. But the school, at the end of it, is like, we still don't even have that much. And Dan was really upset because he's like, oh, my gosh, I thought I was going to have like a plaque of, you know, my name on the front of the building that I was going to save them this hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it just didn't work out. So, you know, that was unfortunate. And I think one of the big public successes we had, matter of fact, the blog that I wrote that I couldn't believe how well it went over, is I had a student that was morbidly obese and not really wanting, he was borderline suicidal. And so two of my students in the innovation class end up like working, everybody, we all end up pitching in together and working on that project. And that was great because, you know, we had read like Dr. John Medina's brain rules and learned about how exercise won't just make you healthier, it'll make you smarter. And one thing led to another teacher pitched in and actually took it over, and so we started like this, almost this underground walking club where we didn't want to make an announcement like, hey, attention to anybody that feels like they're overweight, we're starting to meet, but it was like this grassroots thing that started with the student, and it kind of grew, and it was healthy lifestyles and better eating decisions, and it got done quietly, which I love, because we weren't just necessarily showing off, we were trying to get things done, and Leslie still is doing that to this day. So great things that can come out of this class.
Super cool.
So my question then for you is, what is the biggest thing that you've learned in the last year then, Don, that you personally have learned?
Kids want to be meaningful more than anything. The dangling carrot that I thought maybe worked for this or that is, I think that ultimately, well, I mean, it really kind of goes back to the Dan Pink talk, that purpose, you know, the autonomy and is nice, and the mastery is nice, but it's the purpose. I think a lot of our youth wants to do, they just don't know how to get there. You know, we have, and this is something I'm so proud of with my own children, is that they've made that transformation from being consumers to producers. I give credit where Kevin Honeycutt is the one that put that in my head. He bought Ben some equipment a long time ago, and he said, look, if I'm going to buy you technology, you have to be a producer of it, not just a consumer. And I've passed that on to my children. My students love to produce content now, and that gets things done. You ask a lot of kids, hey, do you want to make a difference in the world? Of course they do. Of course they do. But they don't know where to begin. It's like having that really cool idea. Okay, we have a lot of cool ideas. Let's produce something that gets things done. And I think that's my biggest takeaway, is that the students want desperately to work on things that matter. I think it was Anthony Salcido at Microsoft asked my kids, he's like, look, next time the teacher says, you know, why is this on the test? Or no, why are we learning this? And if the answer is because it's on the test, it may not have that much meaning. Well, in some cases, you have to obviously do things that are on test, but they want to work on things that mean a lot to them, but then make that shift from producing something that can make it happen.
Just before we get to our last question here, I just want to follow up on something you said earlier about the kids were, you know, pulling their own standards and doing that kind of thing. Are they just pulling standards that relate to that project from all content areas then? Is that how that looked with that?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the process too, that they have to, I mean, sometimes they'll load it down and they're hoping like some of them will be a grasp, but I'm like, come on. I tell them that I want at least three, but I get some kids that legitimately knock out, I mean, depending, you know, some of the college and career readiness stuff. But, well, for example, the one on the solar power, when he was converting kilowatt hours to square cubic footage and all this other, I'm not a math person, but he was doing some math. This is where sometimes I lose some of my audience in the sense that they go, well, they get fired up about the standards and, you know, are you for or against the Common Core? I'm neither. I'm not a politician. So when they, you know, when they say, hey, do you cover the standards? I said, yes, they cover the standards. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, legitimately, I'll instead of them just putting it down on a piece of paper, we talk it out. They substantiate to me on what they're doing. Yeah, sometimes it's in a variety of areas, that's for sure. It's not just an English standard.
Cool. So the last thing we usually like to ask our guests is just what's something you're just really passionate about right now? Clearly it's innovation projects and those kinds of things, but anything else that kind of comes to mind?
Traveling. I'm passionate about, as a matter of fact, towards the end of the book, I talk about the new roles of an innovative educator, and they were project manager, which we've gone over, public relations agent, which we could spend an hour talking about how if you want to change the perception of public education, put yourself out there, get a YouTube channel, show your students, you know, show everybody what your students are doing. And the other last two things were travel agent and venture capitalist. I love traveling. And even if people say, well, I don't have any money, sometimes a fourth grade class taking a field trip to the fifth grade class is eye-opening. Every time you leave your environment, it's anew. And when you come back, you're changed. So I'm really, really, really passionate about travel, whether it's in the courtyard for an afternoon or trying to go out to, you know, Google headquarters and pick their brain. If you ever get a chance to travel, do it. Really, awesome. Really passionate about that.
Yeah. Good. I am too. We're travelers. My wife and I are big travelers, and I, you know, we're leaving the kid at home. Sorry. Right now we got a little, you know, 1-year-old at home, and it's like, we're going to New York and over Thanksgiving, and it's just like, we gotta get out of here. We gotta see the world. So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thanks, Don. I really appreciate you taking some time with us this evening. That was amazing. It's finally good to get to speak with you. I've heard a lot about you from Dave and just follow you on Twitter, and we've, you know, been had some communication in the past. It's really good to meet you face to face.
Yeah.
Talk about
anytime ways you want to partner up on something, anytime you want to cross-pollinate, you guys, or for that matter, whoever's watching, you can always find me at Don Wetrick on Twitter. Email me, dwetrick@gmail.com. My students love to work with other students as well.
Cool. Blog. How about a blog?
Oh, yeah, theinnovationteacher.com. And, boy, I've got work to do. I try to do it on my own. I merge some things. So the blog part of that website is getting a little bit – I'll work on it.
they can find the book there, right? And I'm assuming on Amazon.
Yeah, and on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, it looks like this. Yeah,
great job with the cover. I know that you said Dave did it, and he's got that real cool cover on his book, and you have the same on that. You guys copy the book.
Yeah, he really recommended that I go with that silky smooth finish, and it was kind of my idea to have fonts of. So we got the Facebook font, the Twitter font. Anyway, I can't tell you how much fun it was publishing a book with a guy who's had that kind of track record. And has been just my biggest cheerleader and supporter. So he's been great. Just great. Yeah.
So ways you can connect with us, Twitter, you can find us at EduAllStarsHQ, and then you can use the hashtag EduAllStars. We're also at EduAllStars.com, and then you can find previous episodes on iTunes. Just search out EduAllStars with no spaces. You'll see all 67 episodes there, and look forward to hearing from you.
And you can join us every Sunday this month at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. Next Sunday, we interview Nathan Barber. And then on the 19th, we interview Colby Sharp. And on the 26th, we interview Ginny Bukos. So make sure you just check us out online or on eduallstars.com Sunday nights at 8 p.m. and Central Standard Time, and you can see all the interviews. Thank you so much, Don, for coming on. It was really great getting to hear you talk about some Genius Hour and your journey, and it was just a great experience.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks, Don.